This is a Collider.com audio interview.
I guess, are you enjoying your weekend of press?
It feels like it gets more brutal as the years go by, not less, just in terms of the amount, the intensity of it. The good thing is it's an interesting film to talk about, and there's a lot to talk about, which is nice.
I saw your film at TIFF. And to be honest with you, man, I absolutely loved it, and it was one of my two favorites out of the festival.
Oh, thank you.
Are you sort of... I mean, everyone I speak to who sees the movie, I've not heard a bad word. Are you sort of dumbfounded by the, you know, the critics and everyone sort of, you know, jumping up and down for it?
It's been a pretty astonishing and overwhelming response. I mean, there's no way, you know, you'd never predict this kind of response, because it's been overwhelming, particularly when... Festivals, Telluride and Toronto, when it started, it was extraordinary and over and amazing. And I spent months locked in dark rooms, and you hope it's going to play well, but you can never expect that kind of reaction. And what I really like is just sitting in audiences, and you know, it really makes people laugh in such a communal way, and it really makes people cry, and it transports people. And I find after the screening, people really want to come and, you know, come and tell you what they feel, and people get very passionate about it, and that's fantastic.
Something that when I speak to people about the film, I mention how you've done something. Sorry, this is a rambling kind of question. The fact is, a lot of period movies feel like you could be watching them on Lifetime. They have no sort of cinematic depth. But your movie has a lot of cinematic depth, and it belongs on a movie screen. Could you sort of talk about, as a director, what you did to prepare to make sure that it would be cinematic and it wouldn't be something that you would want to just watch on Lifetime?
That's interesting. I mean, I think one of the things I worked out early was that because there was the amount of dialogue, and also the nature of the emotions that Colin was going to go through, that the film was going to have a lot of... The film was going to... The film was the language, the film was going to be the close-up. And there's no point fighting that, because, I mean, it was the cinematic close-up was going to be key. And therefore, I was thought a lot about how to make the close-up cinematic, because it can be a frustrating shot to frame, because it's really someone, you know, in composition terms, it's the face, and if you look at classic Hollywood movies, they tend to shoot close-ups on quite long lenses, and the background is just out of focus, you know, it's just a mush. And so I decided early on that I would consider shooting the close-ups on wider lenses than normal. And what that does is, even in the close-up, it draws the art direction, the set location, into the frame, and the face still remains in communication with the space, and which I think is more cinematic. And there was a French film I saw years ago called Seul contre tous, which I think was translated as Man Against the World, where there were these, you know, wonderful, simple frames of close-ups against wallpaper in a room, which were incredibly visually powerful. Or, you know, I think of a filmmaker like Wong Kar-wai in 2046, who, you know, does simple compositions of people. You know, it's a futuristic movie, but he can shoot someone against in mid-shot in a hallway, and the texture of the hallway is so fascinating that it feels really cinematic. And more than that, I also began to think, well, what's the visual analog? I'm stammering. You know, how do I find a way of shooting Colin that's going to underline his predicament? And, you know, I began to think if you're a stammerer, it's about inhabiting silence and emptiness and nothingness. And therefore, is there a way visually of talking about that? And so I wanted to put Colin's face in these close shots in relation, Colin's face in relationship to negative space. So I used these big empty walls in the consulting room in Loeb's apartment, and framed Colin against these big empty walls. Sometimes he's small in the corner with the wall above and overpowering him. Sometimes there's just a lot of headroom, and I like the idea of Colin's face in communication with kind of nothingness, this blasted wall in the therapy room. And then if you look at what I'm doing on Jeffrey's side, you know, Jeffrey is against, you know, in the therapy room, in the consulting room, like the fireplace and the clutter of all his and pictures on the wall and papers, and it's domestic and it's cozy. And I wanted to make that kind of division between, in the close-up language, between, you know, these two men and the world they came from.
Well, could you also talk a little bit about the editing process and how long was it for you in the editing room? And did you do test screenings or friends and family screenings?
We finished shooting the film late January of this year, and I think Tarik Anwar is a superb editor. He cut American Beauty, he cut Magic King George, hugely experienced, and I think the rhythm of his editing is astonishingly good. And you know, we had a pretty good cut, probably 7 or 8 weeks out from the shoot, and we tested, a cut in New York in April with Harvey, and we actually got 93% in our New York test, which is very rare, I'm told. And so I then said to Harvey, well, you know, maybe this is a New York sophisticated thing, and you know, I want to know if it plays somewhere unlike New York. And so he set up a tester in Kansas City, and extraordinarily the same result came back, 93% in terms of audience response. But I mean, I found that test very useful because there were definitely things about the history that people didn't know, like the audience didn't even know that Wallace Simpson was American unless you pointed out. So I definitely had to do a bit of work to make sure that the history side was clear, because I think I was assuming more knowledge than people had. So the testing process was both very encouraging because of our scores, but also helpful in terms of, you know, just the clarity of the storytelling. And I think we kind of locked up the edit early May, so you know, it was a good rhythm. It was okay.
This is sort of a jokey question, but the last few people that have worked for you have all won Golden Globes. Basically, actors that work for you win awards. Are you sort of just going to start printing out cards or something, reminding people when you're looking to cast? Is it?
Well, I mean, if you look at the cast I assembled for this, you know, I hope it's partly, in fact, I could get such great actors in really quite small roles. You know, like Sir Michael Gambon came in for 2 scenes. You know, I got Tim Spall to come in for, you know, 3 scenes, and I think what happens is, you know, actors get quite loyal to you. I mean, a lot of these people I've worked before, I love more than, I mean, my two great loves when I'm shooting are working with great actors and composing images, and I love being around great, particularly great clever actors. I just hope if this continues to happen, it just helps encourage other good actors I haven't worked with that they could perhaps work with me.
I really enjoyed your work also on John Adams. If you could just briefly talk about the involvement you had on that show and working for HBO.
Yeah, well, I mean, I directed all 9 hours of it, so it was you know, my 18th century Lord of the Rings, except I didn't have armies of orcs to contend with. It was a vast show, an extraordinary privilege to be making this thing, knowing it's going to go out during the US primaries, and knowing that there wasn't much else being made. And I had this opportunity, I felt, on the show to trace back the origin of this incredible schism in American political values, and see if you could trace that schism back, that divide back, to the personalities of the founders. And, you know, I think HBO is an extraordinary entity that it was willing to spend over $100 million telling the story of the non-famous founding father. Because, I mean, let's not forget, before the miniseries, John Adams, and former Cullet's book, John Adams was the kind of guy who was not on the pedestal. He was not iconic in the way that Washington and Jefferson and Franklin were. And, you know, Adams knew it in his own lifetime. So it was kind of, I love the subversiveness of that. And in some ways, you know, there is a quality in my work where I like choosing, you know, subversive ways in to these, you know, famous iconic stories.
Well, I mean, obviously the experience, I think that the series is tremendous. Have you talked to HBO or others about possibly doing another miniseries on that level, or was it the time involved just so tremendous that you're almost apprehensive to go back?
I have already started talking to them about something. It's not for the immediate. You know, it's a little bit down the line, but no, I would definitely go back. But I hope that the industry is maturing to the place where there isn't a snobbery distinction between film and television, because it's about your story. If your story is John Adams, you can't tell it as a movie. You need, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours to do it justice. If your story is The King's Speech, it tells beautifully as a movie. And I think you need to pick, you know, the medium for the story, and not try to shoehorn big stories into films, and equally not stretch out slim stories over 8 hours. You know, to be.
I read a quote with you that basically you were mentioning something about how English TV, you know, a few decades ago was, just so amazing, and now how American television has really stepped up. And I would argue that this is probably the best time in the history of, this is the golden age of TV, with the abundance of channels and the stories you're able to tell.
I mean, The Wire was the most phenomenal achievement, you know, in terms of an anatomy of an urban culture in America over 70, 80 hours. I mean, I do think it's in large part down to HBO, who seemed to, you know, I don't know if you know, but the founder of the BBC, Lord Reith, had this idea of television is there to inform, educate, and entertain. And this is something that commercial broadcasters haven't really embraced. And the extraordinary thing about HBO is it almost seems to be adopting those wonderful ideals of the early BBC, that it's not just about entertainment, it's about educating and informing, and yet doing it while making a ton of money for its shareholders. And it seems to have squared the circle. I mean, you know, growing up, I tended to think that if you're being commercial, you couldn't be intelligent, or if you were being commercial, you couldn't educate or challenge. And HBO have always had the confidence to think you can. And in some ways, the way I've made the King's Speech shows my confidence. I mean, you know, what HBO taught me in terms of America was that there is a very clever and very large audience out there, and you don't need to talk down to them. And HBO never wanted me to simplify anything because they were worried their audience wouldn't understand it. HBO always assume their audience is bright, and I like working with that assumption. And King's Speech is made with that assumption, and I hope that, you know, if it is successful, it'll prove that there is a bright audience out there that's big, you know.
Well, I definitely have to address this with you. I've covered movies for a number of years now, and I'm just absolutely confident, or beyond confident, that your film is getting nominated for Best Picture. Your actors are going to get recognition. You're going to get recognition. It's a very special movie. I mean, can you sort of talk about the fact that you're heading towards that line, if you will? And I don't mean to, like, you know, to put it out there or jinx anything, because it's not jinxable. Your film is...
Well, I mean, I just kind of want to take one every day as it comes and not make any assumptions. And, you know, I'm just thrilled at the response we've had. I'm thrilled at the awards we've won. Like, the Audience Award in Toronto was an unbelievable thing to win, to be voted by in that popular vote. And really, at the moment, I just hope that, you know, people really go and see it when it's released on Thanksgiving, and that people discover it, because it's a really entertaining and absorbing and a humorous and moving night out of the cinema. And having seen how profoundly people respond to it, I would be crazy not to want everyone to see it, you know. And it's very democratic. I mean, it plays the same in England as America as it plays in Canada. You know, it's equally funny to lots of different audiences, and it seems to make, you know, people cry, whoever they are. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of very special when you have one of those films that seems to democratically include everyone rather than exclude some people.
If you don't mind, I definitely want to ask your thoughts on 3D. I ask this about every director. Do you view it as a gimmick, or do you view it as something that's going to be here to stay for a while, and you're thinking about maybe doing a period piece or a future project in that format?
I think it's here to stay. I think if you look at I can't say this for America, but there's in England, if you look at the investment Murdoch's made on Sky Television to bring 3D TV into the mass marketplace, that's a pipeline that's going to need feeding. So with people making that kind of investment, I think it's here to stay. I mean, the only thing I would say, I suppose, you know, for me, good films create the illusion of 3D anyway. I mean, when you're watching The King's Speech, you don't keep going, but this is only 2D, you know, because if you're inside the story, you forget all that. It becomes very real to you. So I think I'm not sure every film will end up being made 3D. I think there'll always be types of film that are best served. But I think it's a hugely exciting new development, and if it helps rejuvenate the cinema, which it appears to be, that's only good.
Well, and if you don't mind, another sort of technical question: are film versus digital, and what are your thoughts on either or?
Well, it's interesting. I still capture on film. This was shot on 35mm. I've never actually yet shot on digital. But I am a fan of digital cinema projection. So my favourite route at the moment is to capture on 35 and to project digitally. do because the consistency of the digital projection system and its faithfulness to the way I graded it is so impressive. I was with Ridley the other day on Friday, and we were talking about it, and he was just saying that he was a convert to digital projection as well, just because, you know, it's just much more faithful to the way you want to see the film come out.
And, oh, I was going to say, if you don't mind doing the sort of question about casting, but could you sort of talk a little bit about, you know, was it a complicated casting process? Did you get your first choices? You know, could you sort of talk about those initial meetings?
I think with Colin and I just was very lucky that I ended up with the right man doing it. I mean, I think the success of the film is a real testament to him just being the right casting. And I'm such a believer that it's, you know, you've got to get this casting right, not 10% off, but true and right. And it's tough to do, you know, because there are only a certain number of actors who can attract the finance and who are also great. But I think in the central, you know, across the board, but particularly those central choices of Helena, Colin and Jeffrey, there's something very right about them, which I think is why the film's playing well.
And if you don't mind, I know I have to wrap up with you, but could you sort of talk a little bit about what you're thinking about for future projects? And has the success of the movie possibly, you know, led to you having more meetings in quote-unquote Hollywood?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a ton of scripts sent to me, and, you know, at the moment I'm frankly struggling to catch up and read all the scripts, so I haven't decided what I'm going to do next, but my first job is to try to catch up on the reading that I'm behind on.
Well, has it led to you having all of a sudden more meetings, though, at different studios with people?
Without doubt.
Have you enjoyed it, or is it something that it's you know, being the one that everyone wants to date?
Sorry, say again?
I said, have you enjoyed being the one that everyone wants to date?
I hadn't thought of it like that. Yeah, but there's still, you know, the problem remains, there's still not that, you know, it's hard to find great scripts and great material, and you know, the truth is the King's Speech, which is great material, people weren't lining up to finance it, and it was, you know, thanks to people like Harvey that it did get financed, and I'm not naive that, you know, there may be material I want to do that's still hard to finance, you know, I think it remains, you know, whatever success you have, it doesn't necessarily automatically mean your films can get financed easily.
Hi, it's Danny. Sorry to interrupt, but I need to grab him for another interview.
I completely understand. Let me hit